Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to another edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Our podcast brought to you by Third Wave Water and ThirdWaveWater.com. Do you ever wonder why the coffee you have at your favorite coffee shop doesn't taste like the coffee you have at home? Well, Third Wave Water holds the key to the answer. Check them out at ThirdWaveWater.com. Receive 10% off your first order by using the promo code FOCUS. We're set to talk about home improvement retailers once again today, as well as more store closures for Sears and Kmart, and a surprisingly positive earnings release from Tailored Brands. But we start off today's show with Duluth Trading Company. This is the company that led off our quick scan series on YouTube as they released their earnings post-market on Tuesday, June 6th. And their stock took quite a beating afterwards. In fact, it sunk to a 52-week low, started out the day Wednesday at $18.15, and sunk all the way down to $17 per share. Quite surprising considering they've been over $38 in the last year. Now, this earnings report is for their fiscal first quarter of 2017. Analysts had a consensus estimate in terms of earnings per share of 6 cents. And the company did not specify an estimate on their part. They only give out yearly estimates for their earnings per share. They came in with a profit of just 1 cent. So the fact that they missed on earnings seems to be fueling a lot of this market pessimism.
Absolutely. And you could tell from the conference call that it was a somewhat rough first quarter for Duluth. In fact, Stephanie Pugliese started in the call by thanking their CFO and the entire management team over the last few months and the work they've put in. Despite the miss on profit, their net sales did increase year over year to $83.7 million for the quarter. That's a 21.9% increase, so a fairly healthy increase. And management was quick to point out that it marked their 29th consecutive quarter of increased sales year over year. And you see the operating results overall are nothing for the company to be ashamed about. The retail stores, that is the brick and mortar sales alone, saw a 139.7% growth. And you see, despite increasing their store count by only 9 at the end of the quarter, the overall performance of the brick and mortar did fairly well. You saw same store sales increasing, and direct sales too. The direct to consumer sales from their e-commerce business increased almost 6%, and their gross profit as a percentage of net sales also went up, underscoring that this bottom line difference is driven almost entirely from selling, general, and administrative expenses that were up due to increased promotional activity. And you have to wonder why they're marketing so much more, and you see the reasons as to why they are. In an apparel business such as Duluth's, it really is important to address the consumer and try to retain those existing customers and to get new ones. They cited that new customers in the online business were actually up 31%, and then they drove up traffic for the quarter up 17%, which was about 200 basis points higher than the growth in the first quarter last year. So you see them actually growing more sequentially and year over year. So a lot of positives from this business to glean. The only thing that we were questioning about the e-commerce sales, at least, is that even though the comps were up 6%, them citing that new customers were up 31% means that they actually need to maybe spend more in marketing to try to retain those existing customers. That means those people that have had a previous transaction in the past year or two have not been going back to the level that you would like to see. Really, the management did an excellent job in their opening statements kind of trying to address this, saying that usually for the first quarter during the month of February, they have a lot of clearance sales. However, they didn't have as much due to lesser promotional activity that surrounded the clearance section because those inventory levels were so low. There's a positive and a negative there. One, the positive being that they are selling through merchandise at the higher rate. The negative, obviously, being that they have less overall presence with e-commerce marketing.
And you can look at that 31% spike in customers or new customers on their e-commerce side and see that the direct sales increased just 5.7% and say maybe they could use a little bit of help keeping existing customers around. But I prefer to look at the difference in number between the new customers and the traffic increase. Traffic increased 17%. New customers increased 31%, which means their conversion rates are going up. Their cart abandon rates are going down. All of those are positive signs for a predominantly e-commerce retailer. But as Leighton mentioned, they're putting more and more eggs into the brick and mortar basket because the markets in which they have physical stores, they see e-commerce sales going up in that area. They celebrated this week their 22nd store overall in the U.S., their second store in Pennsylvania as they opened one up in the Pittsburgh metro area. They've increased their brick and mortar retail holdings twofold in the last 2 years, 6 openings so far in the fiscal year to date, with 7 more leases signed. They actually increased guidance for the total number of new stores they would be opening this year. They spied initially 10 to 12 new stores nationwide. They're now looking at least 13 new stores. And again, all of those are either stores that have already been opened or leases that they have signed. They opened stores in Boston, Detroit, Indianapolis, and Providence alone in the first quarter. And they expect even more openings, of course, as the year goes on. But a lot of the market pessimism was born out of that increase in selling, general, and administrative expenses, which were up many, many basis points as a percentage of net sales. And that's where that profit miss came from. But as Leighton mentioned, the advertising is necessary for a retailer that many see as up and coming. Their advertising expenditures as a percentage of net sales up over 25% this last quarter. And the company said they felt like these advertising expenditures were necessary in order to target a new customer base, most importantly, females, with their No Yank Tank line. And sure enough, they saw considerable strength in not only that line, but the rest of their female lines on their website and in the brick and mortar stores. So their advertising expenditures appear to be working. And as I've mentioned on the YouTube segment earlier this week, eventually the law of diminishing returns will come into play. You figured that advertising spend will begin to tail off as they create more and more customer habits. And it certainly appears as though they're doing so, although Leighton mentioned they could certainly use a few more retained customers year over year, but we're still operating with very small sample sizes. Again, just 22 retail stores going into the rest of this second quarter. And they are a relatively new publicly traded company, so we don't have a lot of financials to base this off of. But I think both you and I, Leighton, see optimism for the future rather than pessimism. You look at their price to earnings ratio and it's under 25, whereas it's over 300 for a company like Restoration Hardware. And in my opinion, these companies are going in opposite directions. Duluth still has plenty of white space for growth, plenty of runway for growth in terms of brick and mortar, especially in the United States, whereas Restoration Hardware, they're a little bit more capped as far as what they can do, and the market feels like they can maybe get back to where they used to be. But I really do believe that better times are ahead in terms of profitability for Duluth, and that this short-term miss on profit is exactly that. It's a short-term miss, and larger profits are in the future, and the company even underscored this by retaining their full year outlooks in terms of earnings and in terms of sales.
Yeah, I think that was a positive, and that's one of the things they highlighted also on their official press release was the fact that they reiterated full fiscal year's guidance. And you see that their balance sheet looks good with no borrowings or revolving line of credit, and they have cash of around $13.6 million with $59.1 million in working capital. So overall, their finances are good, and this is a retailer that we've been saying for a year and a half now is growing responsibly. And even though they are a publicly traded company that comes with those shareholder expectations, and you have to look into what the analyst insights always are going to be, keep in mind, put this in perspective, in September of 2012, they opened only their second retail store, 8,000 square feet in Washington State. And you can see from a presentation from Stephanie Pugliese at that time that they were very unsure about the future as brick and mortar was becoming a bigger part of their business. This is a 25-year-old business that had predominantly been in the e-commerce space and the catalog space. And so right now, you're seeing a company that is responsibly growing. You see no debt on the balance sheet, and you see a company that is profitable and knows how to market. The only obstacles they see in the immediate future are trying to keep up with the new age ad expenditures and the other ways to try to target their core consumers. And I think finding that core consumer is priority number one for them as they try to expand out their brick and mortar presence and then try to draw in more online sales from those physical stores. We move on to our second story, and we'll keep with apparel as Tailored Brands released their first quarter earnings report, and they actually aren't that bad. Tailored Brands has a vast and mostly high-end portfolio, their largest brand being Men's Warehouse. They also own Joseph A. Bank, Moore's Clothing for Men, and mall staple K&G, and we'll get into those in a little bit, but as you can see, they also have a corporate apparel sales business and cleaning services. We won't really delve into them. The overarching results, Trent, are somewhat mixed. As a result of some closures, their net sales did decrease by 5.5% for the first quarter. This compares to the first quarter of 2016, where they saw revenues of $828.8 million in top-line revenue. They really are trying to right-size their business. They're trying to hone down what they do well, but you can see there is a little bit of a conflict here. And if you go back in time, back when Men's Warehouse was being criticized by analysts, basically saying that Joseph A. Bank was being the better retailer, and then they ended up buying them for $1.8 billion back in mid-2014. So they really haven't been able to capitalize on all of those synergies, those really good things that Joseph A. Bank brought to the table, such as marketing and the design in their stores. But they're trying to get a grasp on what their different customers are wanting. And they did show GAAP earnings per share of 4 cents per share, which actually ended up comparing favorably to last year's GAAP earnings per share of 3 cents. This means they're operating a little bit more efficiently, especially when you compare that to that 5.5% decrease in top line revenue. That means they are beginning to understand more about their core business and every asset that they own. Their bottom line actually could have been larger if not for the exit agreement they struck with Macy's, and Trent will get into that a little bit later. But costs associated with that program eroded earnings per share by a whopping 19 cents per share. So if you look at the adjusted mark in profit, they would have made 27 cents per share, and this actually would have beat consensus estimates of around 20 cents per share. So regarding those comparable retail sales, this again was a little bit of a mixed bag, but mostly negative. We see Men's Warehouse decreased 3.1% versus a decrease of 3.5% in 2016. But Trent, the story here, part of the story here is that K&G plummeted 7.4% versus a slight decrease of 0.2% in 2016. But it's interesting in that they were the only concept that actually added stores during the last 12 months.
That's right. And part of that top line revenue erosion that Leighton spoke of is as a result of so many store closures. We've talked throughout the last couple of years about Tailored Brands trying to right size their portfolio, removing some of the redundant stores where there were Joseph A. Bank stores near Men's Warehouse stores, or vice versa. And of course, he referenced ending the Macy's program. But the fact that they're building out the K&G brand and their same store sales went down by so much, 7.4%, that is certainly a negative sign for them going forward. But they did mention they were able to add women's wear to several K&G stores during the last quarter. So maybe a slight positive and maybe a way in which they can turn things around. Moore's decreased 5.3% in terms of comparable store sales versus a decrease of 3.9% last year. So it's not like they were going up against great quarters last year. The lone positive from same store sales is Joseph A. Bank, which longtime listeners or retail followers will recall was pretty much at this time last year a dumpster fire. Their same store sales were down 16% in the first quarter of fiscal year 2016. So the fact that they did jump up this quarter at 3.5% is a result of both weak comps and also closing a lot of their underperforming stores, these stores that had weak same store sales in the prior year. They also noticed an increase in transactions in Joseph A. Bank, but a decrease in average unit retail, meaning that they're spurring traffic, getting through the doors, spurring people at the checkouts, But due to reduced tag prices and increased promotional activity, their end sale result isn't that much higher. A main takeaway, though, from all of their same-store sales metrics is that they were relatively unhappy with their February comps. In fact, some of their stores' February comps were down nearly double digits, but March and April helped to turn these numbers around. And this continues a trend that several retailers have noticed, Duluth Trading Company being one of those, JCPenney another, many of the mall retailers in the same boat. They all complained of very soft Februarys but strong months in March and April. So I'm not sure if this is symptomatic of potentially stronger sales May, June, July, and so forth, but it certainly is symptomatic of a weak February throughout the retail industry, particularly in apparel. It seems like this softness has been amplified by delays in tax returns, which we've discussed earlier on the show, especially for higher end stores or stores like we've talked about in the past, Finish Line, for example, where customers might be getting their tax returns back and spending them on sneakers or potentially a Veblen good of some sort. Another takeaway here from this earnings call is that the company is certainly being more efficient. Leighton mentioned feeling out their store portfolio, making sure that synergies were realized between Men's Warehouse and Joseph A. Bank. And I think this is a positive going forward, especially since the company openly admits in a transitional period of time. And Leighton, there was other information that they went over on the earnings call that I think was a lot better than many analysts expected.
We discussed advertising expenditures with Duluth Trading, and here we see that Tailored Brands spent $42.3 million, which was actually a decrease of 40 basis points as a percent of total sales. They came in with 5.4% of total revenue going to their marketing campaigns, and this is actually in line with most fashion retailers. Their selling, general, and administrative expenses were up slightly as a percentage of total sales year over year, due in part to closures and the less total scale of a company. And you see that as a company downsized, they have to do it effectively, and it looks as though they weren't that effective in trying to lower their footprint. And one piece of positive news, though, however, related to their overall performance is that they did reaffirm their GAAP earnings per share outlook for the rest of the year. So like Duluth, they are reiterating guidance. And Trent had mentioned those store closures. So if we go back through and look at their entire store portfolio, we can see what exactly they closed and maybe some areas of weakness they might see going forward. In the last year, Tailored Brands closed one Men's Warehouse store, 112 Joseph A. Bank stores, and 97 Men's Warehouse stores and Tuck stores. Overall, just two K&G stores were added, but they've made it a point now that they've added that women's apparel business to several of these stores in the last year. They have positive outlook so that 95% of their 91 locations will have women's apparel. And this is an interesting point because, Trent, you had mentioned adding this, but yet their same store sales are decreasing. So this is a point that we will emphasize when looking at the future earnings calls for the retailer. But there will be fewer store closures over the next three quarters other than the Macy's program. And Trent, you're about to talk about that program. But it's interesting in that they did see guidance increase from 10 net store closures in fiscal 2017 to 20. The reason they give for the increase is an initiative to continue to reduce the number of Joseph A. Bank stores while leases on some locations are expiring. Again, sort of a trend you're seeing with current retail and something we'll talk about in the last story here for the Retail Focus. But this is a relatively positive sign, as positive as store closures can be. They are attempting to right-size their store base at their leisure rather than hurriedly closing and shutting down stores and incurring those extra costs associated with breaking leases and that sort of thing. But exiting the Macy's partnership is something that is a very large part of the story overall and something that did cost them on the bottom line.
If we talk about being able to save money by waiting until leases are up for some of these Joseph A. Bank closures, they did not do that with Macy's. And of course, not necessarily leases you're worried about there, but just breaking the program in general. There were a lot of costs incurred. The interesting thing about these closures of the tuxedo shop at Macy's, which was what the store-in-store concept was called, is that as recently as the end of fiscal 2016, they were adding to these store-in-store locations. They actually saw net new openings despite the fact that Macy's stores in and of themselves were closing in the country. On the whole, these store-in-store concepts, especially for department stores, have been kind of a mixed bag. For Macy's, as we can see, the tuxedo shop not really working, at least as far as the men's warehouse is concerned. For Kohl's, their store-in-store attempts have been kind of underwhelming. For JCPenney, though, they've been a big revenue driver. We've mentioned the Sephora store-in-store concept being a big builder onto JCPenney, both in top-line revenue and in profit. But this particular store-in-store program didn't appear to be working, at least for one of the parties, that one party being Tailored Brands. In the upcoming second quarter, all 126 of these existing tuxedo shop store-in-store concepts will be shuttered, or as the company is fond of saying, wound down. You notice at the top of their press release out in May, regarding these store-in-store closures, they mentioned wound down, and they did so again in this earnings release. This was, again, announced May 3rd of this year. They continued to take reservations at these tuck shops in Macy's until June 1st, 2017. Operations will end officially by July 14th, 2017. And closing a store-in-store concept such as this is a little bit different than just closing a retail store or closing a store elsewhere, because this is a reservation and rental system. So this has some trickiness to it, since reservations for weddings and large events are often made months in advance. You can't just liquidate your store assets and lay off the employees and lock the doors, especially in areas without another Tailored Brands freestanding store nearby the Macy's. You have to try and honor as many of those reservations as possible so as not to turn away customers for the future. Regarding this closure, in this week's earnings release, their CEO Doug Ewert said that, and I quote, "We were pleased to have reached an agreement with Macy's to wind down our tuxedo rental partnership, which eliminates the risk of extended future operating losses and enables us to focus on our rental business at Men's Warehouse, Joseph A. Bank, and Moores," end quote. There are two takeaways from an analyst's perspective from this quote. First of all, and perhaps foremost, the locations were unprofitable in and of themselves and at risk of losing the company even further money. Secondly, and I think most interestingly, they felt that these store-in-store concepts were perhaps robbing from the rental businesses at their own locations, given that in a number of retail districts, you'll have Macy's stores very close, within a mile or so, in fact, of a Joseph A. Bank or Men's Warehouse location. And they have, as a company, does Tailored Brands, incentive to push people to rental services at their own brick-and-mortar stores, since there always is the possibility of some impulse buys there and potentially crossover sales as well. According to their non-GAAP statements, the costs of this exit of the Macy's program include $12.3 million in termination costs, $1.4 million in product write-offs, so areas in which they cannot use this rental product at other Tailored Brands locations, $1.2 million of asset impairment charges, and then $2.3 million of miscellaneous expenses. Overall, it did seem necessary for Tailored Brands to try and get out of this circumstance, especially with Macy's struggling on the same store sales front, struggling to keep some of their stores open. It only makes sense to funnel these programs back into their own stores to boost their own brick and mortar profile. If it wasn't making money, it's not something worth keeping around, especially for a business that had struggled somewhat. We began the story late with talking about how this earnings release was better than expected. There are some positives and negatives both. It truly is a mixed bag when it comes to this earnings release.
Yeah, if you look at the final takeaways that we had, the picture of Tailored Brands' future seems a little bit brighter now than a year ago when we were talking about them. The positives are they have taken their pains to right-size their store base, so short-term pains for long-term profitability, and it seems to be working. And then the negatives here are comparable store sales are still falling and still shrinking. And Trent, when you and I were talking about this, I had brought up JCPenney because JCPenney is a retailer that actually became profitable in the fourth quarter for their fiscal fourth quarter. And you see that the company is coming back and rebounding with a fairly strong strategy. However, their last earnings report reported comparable store sales that were still falling. So you have to wonder if their initiatives here, if their marketing campaigns are truly working, and if it was the right decision to end up closing more Joseph A. Bank stores rather than trying to realign the core of their business. But overall, it does appear like they are losing out on some lower end customers. So you will see some drop off in revenue due to the increased popularity of these off-price stores. And you see a lot of incoming competition from the online space as well. A lot of companies that are trying to take advantage and try to have a personal design business from your smartphone. And this is something that they really didn't mention if you go out and look through the conference call comments. But overall, you see that this is a time of flux for the company. A large positive is the fact that they are still profitable and they have increased their gap margins overall. You see those increasing margins that I mentioned on decreasing revenue. And if they can somehow increase their average unit price, because they had talked about reducing the amount of marketing campaigns that they've had, especially with Joseph A. Bank, if they can sort of take that away and take that promotional pricing away, you have to wonder if they can not only increase margins in the short term, but also the long term, and try to regain their posture as an elite retailer in their space. But if you go on their website right now, both Men's Warehouse and Joseph A. Bank are offering $20 off of $100 purchases, just flat out. That's the first thing that's listed on their website. So you have to wonder if what they've said in the past is not really coming to fruition with the strategy of the company in the present.
This episode of the Retail Focus Podcast is brought to you by Third Wave Water and thirdwavewater.com. You know, Leighton, oftentimes the coffee you make at home, well, it doesn't seem up to par with the coffee that you'll get at a coffee shop, particularly one that's in that third wave segment. That's because coffee shops spend thousands of dollars to make the perfect water for making coffee. But guess what? You can replicate this in the comfort of your own home for as little as 10 cents per cup.
That's right, Trent. Third Wave Water has a patent-pending formula of minerals that, when added to a gallon of distilled water, makes for coffee brewing magic. Recently at the U.S. Brewers Cup Championship, both the first and second place finishers brewed their coffee with Third Wave Water.
Check out their website at thirdwavewater.com and use the promo code FOCUS, that's F-O-C-U-S, for 10% off your first order. And what's more, I know we have a lot of retail store owners in our listener base. They offer fantastic wholesale deals on their website as well. So if you want to carry Third Wave Water in your store, it'd be a great idea, honestly. Get good margins on it, and it's a product that's in demand. Check them out, Third Wave Water and thirdwavewater.com.
Well, we're back with home decor and home furnishings retailer At Home as they reported their first quarter fiscal 2018 earnings on Wednesday morning. And overall, this is an interesting story because At Home is primarily a brick and mortar retailer, and they had just recently become publicly traded in August of last year. That's when they had their IPO. And we've discussed this retailer only once before on the podcast. The company is based in Plano, Texas, and has deep Texas roots. The company had been operating under banner Garden Ridge Pottery, which had been founded in 1979. They ended up rebranding in 2014 and showcased the At Home name on all of their brick and mortar stores. AEA, a private equity firm, acquired the chain of stores in 2011. The company had seen hard times financially through the years, and in 2004, they actually had a bankruptcy to show for it. And this is something that we've been talking about and a retailer that we've been keeping our sights on because they're growing out their brick and mortar concept. And they are bullish on the fact that they do not need a transactional e-commerce space to do business. And so we were really questioning, especially after the IPO, their financial sense in the matter. The company inhabits large retail spaces, some up to 100,000 square feet. Some have actually taken over former retail centers. There's one that I'm well acquainted with that actually took over for a Target that had relocated to another area. So again, some housing, a lot of square footage, and you have to wonder if they're going to be able to pay for all the overhead associated with such a large square footage amount. but many analysts were actually bearish on the retailer, also questioning what the IPO would bring in terms of the long-term runway. But it seems as though the company has found traction, and they actually have responded back saying that their runway, according to the response from this quarter, is over 600 stores.
I look at this retailer in a similar light to Ollie's Bargain Outlet, who we talked about last week. Not necessarily that they sell the same thing or even occupy the same space in the retail landscape, but these are companies that seem to have seen a surge after their IPO. Some companies, we mentioned the Container Store in a show last month, don't seem to do so well after their IPO simply because they're in the public eye, and maybe it's just not a company that should be a publicly traded company. But At Home seems to be doing the exact opposite, and it seems like the capital raised through their IPO has given them plenty to work with in terms of building out their brick and mortar store. Although, as Leighton mentioned, they don't really have an e-commerce platform. Their online platform is simply just a preview of what you would find in a typical store. Now let's talk about the results from this earnings report. Again, beating expectations on nearly every front, At Home reported a net income of $10 million or 16 cents per share in the quarter, up from $7.3 million or 14 cents per share in the year earlier period. The more widely reported, so if you saw headlines about this, this is probably what you saw, adjusted earnings per share hit 19 cents, one penny ahead of the FactSet consensus estimates. Revenue was also a beat, coming in nearly $3 million above analyst figures to $211.8 million, growth of 23%, that is, year over year, due almost entirely to an increased store base. And again, having that IPO opened up a little bit of capital, and we see them start to realize some of that room for growth that they saw prior to the IPO in the U.S. In fact, roughly 90% of this revenue increase was actually attributable to the widened store count. Same store sales, which was something that we projected around low single digits, actually came in mid single digits at 5.8% for stores open at least a year. So same store sales going up at a very high rate, even higher than most other home improvement retailers that occupy this sector. Analysts were looking for same store sales at around 3.8%. This is now their 13th straight quarter of positive comps. Now that we've looked at the financials a little bit, we can analyze and say that honestly, we were taken aback a little bit by the success. We expected some measure of success, but this is a massive amount of success. Not only are they opening new stores with a flourish, but they're able to maintain high sales figures at the stores that they have already had open. This is a company that we kind of wondered about coming into the new year simply because of their larger store base. Leighton discussed already the price it takes to keep a large store operating, but they're actually able to leverage their larger square footage stores into a fantastic selection. And this is something that Lee Bird referenced on their conference call.
Yeah, their CEO, Lee Bird, and it was actually recently announced he is now the chairman of the board. They've recently appointed him the chairman of the board. Lee Bird has some deep Texas roots as well as the company does. He's actually part of the Dallas Stars ownership advisory group there, and has a lot of things around the surrounding area that he does to participate, local societies and that kind of thing. But his leadership sense really has pointed the company in the right direction. The first thing he announced during this earnings call was the fact that their merchandising strategy that really has been twisted and turned over the last 4 years has really taken the company to new heights. You see that their new indoor and outdoor selections are bigger than ever, and they really have been focusing on price point. They said value is the number one reason customers are going to fall in love with their selections. And this is true because the at-home retailer that I went into had maybe 3 to 4 times some of the selection of items such as outdoor rugs, indoor furnishings that you would see at a Walmart. The price point was right around what Walmart's is. So you really have to wonder, maybe they do have something here. Maybe they have something that a lot of analysts and people like you and I didn't foresee coming, really trying to take advantage of those larger square footage stores and pushing out inventory and making a very large decor assortment. And this actually relates to the core goal Lee Bird had laid out, and saying that the core goal of the store chain was to have an unbeatable in-store home decor assortment, the largest, freshest, and most relevant at the best value in the industry. And as of the particular categories that the store has, they want to see more home furnishings and more furniture. They noted 38 consecutive months of increased furniture sales. Another strong area was their outdoor section. They mentioned patio. And due to all of this, the increased traffic, the increased basket size that we're seeing, they said that the marketing was an integral part of it. They actually increased the annual marketing target spend around 3% of sales, up from 2.6% of sales in fiscal 2017. And then if you tie that all the way back to fiscal 2016, you're looking at around a 50% increase from those numbers, where they were spending just 2% of their top line revenue. But a more than 100% increase in email subscribers they touted, and 40% more website traffic. However, Trent, you had mentioned this briefly, the fact that they are not actually having a transactional e-commerce platform is interesting, that they would cite the 40% increase in website traffic. But if you're looking through the question and answer session that analysts had with Lee Bird, his response was very interesting when questioned about their e-commerce dynamic. He said, basically, they do not need such a thing to be profitable and successful, and really it's only going to tie in traffic to their brick and mortar stores. But he did emphasize the point of differentiation, where they have now put in every single item that they have in their physical stores in their online space, and they've now tied a price point to each of those items. He said pricing is the number one important thing for customers, and I have to agree with him. The number one frustrating thing for me is to go to a website that doesn't have a transactional platform but still not see a price point associated with those items that you'll see then in the store. So Bird is on top of things, and he said they'll also continue to partner with Synchrony Financial as they've prepared to launch a both co-branded and private label credit card later this year. And they said they want to actually tie in a membership rewards plan for those loyal customers. And he talked a little bit about that and what that might mean for the company. But time and time again, Trent, we've seen where membership programs end up tying in increases in traffic, increases in profitability. Those core customers, those recurring customers, are your most profitable customers. In-store signage enhancements were also talked about. They wanted to make the shopping experience a little bit more easier and comfortable for customers. And this is something I wanted to talk on briefly, in that their large selection of goods, a lot of them are alike. It's important for these larger footprint stores to have appropriate signing, appropriate lighting, and to be able to focus on these things will improve the shopping experience. The last thing you want is for the customer to walk in the store and almost feel lost, like they don't know what's going on or where to find what. So I think this is important, and this is really logical thinking from the leadership teams.
It's almost refreshing to hear an earnings call such as this, where so much attention is given to brick and mortar. And I think that's part of the reason why you see falling brick and mortar sales at certain retailers, is the fact that they've spent so much time and so much energy, so much of their focus on the e-commerce field, which granted is important, but that's not where a lot of these retailers drive profits. And you wonder if some retailers would just put a little bit more thought, a little bit more focus into brick and mortar versus the e-commerce segment, if they would see sales go up like At Home is experiencing with their same store sales. Overall, you see a strong outlook from management, and they, as Leighton mentioned, see a runway for growth of at least 600 domestic stores at maturity. Currently, they're at 129 stores, or at least they were at the first quarter's end. It is, of course, a potential that real estate could be easier for them to find with these 100,000 square foot locations, or even more, with some of these larger outlets like Kmart closing their doors. However, the other question is, where these Kmarts are closing, are they in circumstances or areas that would be fitting the at-home retail concept? Most at-home stores currently are in up-and-coming retail districts. That's where they're looking, and many Kmarts aren't exactly in those up-and-coming retail districts. In fact, that's one of the reasons why the brand overall has struggled. But Leighton mentioned the location that was put into place after Target relocated to a larger building. And that is something that you might see as retailers maybe upgrade their own space or move out. You might see At Home swoop in with some of this real estate. They're encouraged particularly by the positive signs they're seeing in markets throughout the country. They've recently seen openings in just about every region, but mostly the North, South, and Northeast. The company raised their full year guidance overall for fiscal 2018, as this was the first quarter of fiscal 2018, with expected sales of $906 million to $913 million. And they also pushed their adjusted earnings per share up to 73 to 75 cents. As a result of this earnings call, shares rocketed over 8% after the call, from $18 per share to now over $23 per share. Shares are now up 64% from the beginning of the year in just 6 months' time, with a $1.71 billion market cap, which is very remarkable considering their revenue isn't even over a billion, and a price-to-earnings ratio that is just as robust, sitting at 50. JCPenney, to put it in perspective, with almost eight times as many stores, has a market cap of $1.47 billion. So at least on market cap terms, At Home now more valuable than JCPenney. And actually, they're on their way to being more valuable than a number of different legacy retailers. Speaking of legacy retailers, rumors of being taken private have caused shares of embattled upscale retailer Nordstrom to go up over 10% on Thursday, June 8th. Now, Nordstrom is a retailer that is embattled on the stock market, perhaps a little bit more than they are operationally. And Leighton and I have talked about why analysts might be missing a little bit of optimism on Nordstrom, because they are so overwhelmingly concerned with brick and mortar traffic, when Nordstrom has done great things with their e-commerce segment. And honestly, their brick and mortar segment isn't all that bad off. Shares are still down around 12% over the last month. The Nordstrom family is the group that's looking at taking the company private. Initially, they released their IPO in 1978, but a lot of members of the Nordstrom family, including co-presidents Blake Nordstrom, Peter Nordstrom, and Eric Nordstrom, along with president of stores James Nordstrom and chairman emeritus Bruce Nordstrom and Ann Gittinger, are said to be potentially taking part in this deal. You see how many family members are still tied into the management ranks at Nordstrom. Now, we should mention no formal report by the SEC has been made, but it's significant that the company has at least acknowledged their interest in potentially a new strategic direction. And if you're Nordstrom, why not? The shares are at a fairly low price here, and they've received so much public scrutiny over the past 6 months to a year that it seems to make more sense to take themselves private. Now, we should mention Neiman Marcus still comes under scrutiny for losing same-store sales even more than what Nordstrom has, and they are privately held. According to previous company filings, the family owns at least 27.5% of the outstanding shares, but in a new report, the family actually has 31.2% ownership in total of the shares. One analyst in Jim Cramer said that Nordstrom has felt awful about the fact that every time they make expenditures in e-commerce, analysts hammer them. And we remember the whole magic bullet statement one analyst made about a year ago, and that Nordstrom has no magic bullet to bring back store traffic. But honestly, Leighton, I don't know that they are all that concerned, or they should be all that concerned, with their brick and mortar store traffic, considering how robust their e-commerce sales have been of recent. And to be honest, their brick and mortar traffic, especially when you consider their off-price segments, haven't been that bad. And that was reflected on this latest earnings call.
It was, and we discussed that on the Retail Focus podcast. We discussed how their financials really weren't that bad, and they ended up beating expectations in a number of ways. Even though the company had performed well overall, analysts were still pointing to the idea that those large indoor malls were subject to change over the next 10 years, and traffic there has seen declines. However, like you were saying, it really doesn't tie into the overall operations of Nordstrom. But if you look at the 31.2% ownership that you cited, Trent, and we had to dig a little deeper for those numbers, you see that it really is imperative of the management, especially if they're shareholders here, to do what's best for the company. Anytime you're tied in so intimately with the company, You want to see it do well despite the financial news that's out there. So even though the analysts and the media are so negative, it ends up being reflective in the share price. And you see the all-time high of around $83 a share was attained in March of 2015, but all the positive and negative press have really made the share price go back and forth now to about 50% of that all-time high mark. So that means that 31.2% ownership has been cut in half from the dollar standpoint. So a lot of interesting news here. I think from that Jim Cramer statement that you quoted there really does emphasize the fact that they are a little bit frustrated with the negative headlines and the negative press and basically getting a lot of criticism anytime they open a new brick and mortar concept. We had talked a lot extensively actually about the rack concept and how it's really doing well. You see in that last earnings call, their earnings were actually in line with company expectations as well. So the company probably feels like, what more can we do to really turn the media statements around? The company highlighted a more diversified customer base as well, seeing online sales as a proportion of total sales coming in around 24%, driven by an 11% growth in Nordstrom.com and 19% at NordstromRack.com. And then also their successful partnerships with credit card agencies and the total customer count increasing compared to the first quarter of 2016, which was reflective of what they called their ongoing marketing efforts and the efforts to try to acquire a larger store base. And operating cash for the company is still relatively healthy. They reported a very large net income of $63 million in the first quarter. The company's net sales were $3.3 billion in the first quarter versus $3.2 billion in the same period for 2016. So obviously, there are some advantages and disadvantages of being taken private. However, with an already very large ownership stake in the company, it would not take the Nordstrom family too much to try to take over the rest of those outstanding shares. The company would have the ability to right-size the brick-and-mortar locations without having all the negative press associated with the formal press releases. And this is something that we had talked about here recently with Eddie Lampert, as he had complained that a lot of the negative press in the big media outlets have actually caused lower traffic levels in the store, even though that's not necessarily the case with Sears. You could see that the overarching fact is it would lead to some negative press about a retailer that a lot of their customers consider elite in nature. So I think overall, that brand still carries weight. So potentially having some smaller off-price stores would be beneficial for the company, but they might not want to tout that on a public basis.
That's correct, because there is some concern there over the fact that the off-price stores might be eroding slowly the value in the Nordstrom brand. But I do find it a little bit ironic that it's all of this negative publicity and this need by the market to see this crazy result from Nordstrom that is probably unreasonable that would allow Nordstrom to take themselves private, more or less, and for the Nordstrom family to take back Nordstrom and then reap all the profits. I think if you're a shareholder of Nordstrom, you're probably not happy with where the share price is, but you are pretty happy with the 3.3% dividend. And you see a handful of institutional investors that hold Nordstrom. This amounts to about 37 cents per quarter. And when the stock is trading around $45 per share, it makes it one of the strongest retail stocks in terms of dividend, especially considering that the company hasn't seen massive sales losses like you have seen for other companies that have that large of a dividend. Kohl's would be one that comes to mind. So I think it is intriguing about how this retail climate and about how all of this negative press surrounding retail, surrounding malls, surrounding department stores might actually enable the leadership group at Nordstrom and those in this group that would take it private to profit long term from being able to buy the company basically from the public sources.
Yeah, if you and I, Trent, were as wealthy as the Nordstrom family, we would probably consider taking it private as well, because if you look at the overall net margins for the company, you're seeing a company that really hasn't had a problem keeping elite pricing levels in those stores and transferring that into their online business. To see double-digit growth in online carrying some even larger margins than they do inside the stores, that's a very good sign for the company, and it really speaks to the longevity that they may have carrying on their brand name. Moving on to our last story for this edition of the podcast. Well, we mentioned Sears CEO Eddie Lampert briefly in our last story, so it's only right we follow up with the news that came out earlier this week of some more store closures. With this news, it is certainly not surprising to us or anyone that's around retail media to see this happen to the company, as they've really been speaking about potentially closing more stores where the leases are up for renewal. Eight quarterly earnings releases have actually mentioned the fact that they are trying to cut losses. And you see this here this week with the announcement of 66 more locations that are going to be closed to try to trim down the company's portfolio. The closures, Trent, include both Sears and Kmart. And we've long described this cost-cutting measure in the past as sort of a downsizing effort, which really doesn't reflect the core issues of why the business is struggling and trying to stay afloat. You see those same-store sales in a negative position quarter after quarter. This last quarter, we actually reported very briefly on the Sears earnings report, and we said that both Kmart and Sears reported double-digit same-store sales losses.
And keep in mind, this comes after Kmart really wasn't in a terrible position in terms of same-store sales. They were only losing 2 or 3% over the previous year's quarter. And with that, Leighton, honestly, I have to wonder about reasons for closing certain Kmart stores throughout the country. And in fact, we know in a couple of circumstances, having heard from store managers of these Kmarts, that they've actually closed Kmarts in certain markets that outperform other Kmarts in that same market. So you have to wonder if they've got an eye towards real estate as far as that is concerned. And maybe that's a reason why you see the same store sales losses dip into double digits for Kmarts, is that they are actually closing some pretty effectively operating Kmarts in trying to get that real estate opened up. Now, some of the details here, remember we said 66 stores, not 72 stores. You'll see some media outlets mention 72 stores. That's a little bit of an overestimation, because some of those stores that they're counting towards the 72 are actually auto centers that are either built into existing Sears or adjacent to existing Sears. So if they're closing that existing Sears, they're also closing the auto center, in other words. So the actual number, I would say from a retail perspective, is 66. Again, more Kmarts than Sears. 49 Kmart stores scheduled to close, 17 Sears stores, with most of these closing by September. The new closures expand the total to 180 for calendar year 2017, and most likely more to come. The closures, as Leighton mentioned, have a lot to do with store leases being up. If you look at a map of the different closings, they span the entire continental United States, and some of the theories that have been popping around about maybe making either Kmart or Sears a regional brand seem to be undone by this spate of closures. And in fact, Kmart closing a lot more East Coast stores in this line of closures than they have in the past. Notable closures include the last Kmart in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and the last two in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Overall store count with both banners after the closures will be around 1,200. Just 5 years ago, the count was over 2,000. Kmart alone at its peak in 2000 raked in $37 billion in sales and had 2,156 stores. So a sad situation here for Kmart, that they have shrunk to nearly a quarter of their previous size. And when you look at some of these Kmart store closures, you can certainly kind of squint and see why these stores are closing, either in areas that have been kind of left behind in terms of retail or other reasons at hand. But the Sears stores that are closing, I think this is the most interesting, because some of them are actually located in areas or in malls that are doing quite well. For example, Sherman, Texas is a market that is continually growing. It's kind of become a bedroom community for Plano and Dallas, that type of thing. And the retail atmosphere in Sherman is relatively robust. The same thing goes with Columbus, Ohio, which is one of the Ohio markets that is fast growing. They're actually closing two stores in Columbus, the city specifically, and they're closing a store in Midwest City, Oklahoma, which is a suburb of Oklahoma City, one of the largest growing cities or metro areas in the country as of a few years ago. That's tailed off a little bit with the oil industry taking a bit of a hit of recent. But you look at some of the other steers and you understand why they're closing. Minot, North Dakota, for example, it's a small to mid-sized market. You would understand why Sears might be closing there. Dalton, Georgia, Biloxi, Mississippi, kind of the same story with those mid-sized markets. Maybe Sears can't make a run of it there, but I think the more concerning thing is you have some Sears stores and some Kmart stores closing in some major metro areas, and some of these Sears stores are actually in pretty good retail districts where others are having success.
One big takeaway for me is that, as you mentioned, a lot of the closings are from around the country. It's not concentrated to just one market or one particular area. You see, the most of the closings actually happen in California, Michigan, New York, New Jersey, and, as you mentioned, Texas, where they've seen four closings being announced. And I think overall the message here is just one of mismanagement. It's really sad for fans of retail like you and I, Trent, where you see week after week, month after month, retailers that are very mature, that have been in the marketplace for years, having to shutter their doors. And I think one of the reasons is the upper management just staying put and not really seeing a bright future and trying to redesign their business and create another strategy that could work. Anytime you see a very large retailer such as At Home, large in terms of square footage that is, being able to be profitable, you have to look at these Kmart and Sears locations. Some are in very good locations in the marketplace, and you have to wonder, why is it that they are not profitable, or why is it that they have not been able to restructure their business in a way that makes them sustainable for future generations? So really just an overarching feeling of sadness for me, at least, because you had mentioned the number of stores Kmart had in the year 2000, dramatically down from that. And I just hate to see those store closings go, and not to mention the employees and management affected with those closures.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Let's end the Retail Focus podcast on a brighter note, certainly, after discussing a very tough story with Sears and Kmart, a story that actually we've ignored a lot over the past 2 years because it just seems rote at this point. So, Leighton, what story are you looking ahead to over the next week or the next month?
Well, this comes from a retail niche I know very well, and that is with the wholesale space inside the United States, where there are three large players: BJ's Wholesale, Costco, and of course Sam's Club, who is the largest by store count. But my focus here for this story in the looking ahead segment is on BJ's Wholesale Club, as they are actually set to open their first location in South Carolina. And this actually struck me as odd because along the East Coast and Northeast is really where BJ's has the largest amount of stores. So I actually didn't know that they didn't yet have a store in that area. But overall, you see that BJ's is bullish on the future. They had come out with a couple press releases here recently talking about their omni-channel capabilities. And this is something that even Costco still will not talk about to this day, as they see their same store sales increase quarter after quarter. But BJ's is really trying to take advantage of that white space. But it's interesting from a territorial perspective, from the brick and mortar standpoint, that they are also trying to expand out. You see, the company only has 215 clubs and 132 BJ's gas stations that are associated with those clubs in 16 states. So definitely a lot of white space. And when you compare it to both Sam's Club and Costco, both seeing same store sales increases over the last few quarters, you really have to wonder, is there some potential for future expansion? And it's really good to see BJ's expand out into a new state. I know they have a very strong cult following in the states that they do business. So I am curious to see where they go from here.
I'm looking ahead towards a story that'll likely break next Thursday. That would be June 15th, as Kroger holds their first quarter earnings conference call with investors at that point in time. The reason I'm looking ahead towards that is we mentioned so much on the food focus and also the retail focus, the effects of food deflation. have those started to reverse. And Kroger has 2,800 grocery stores throughout the nation, so you get a pretty good pulse on terms of the pricing of food. I absolutely cannot wait to see which direction food is headed. If we see slight inflation or at the very least stagnation, it could be that some of those deflationary effects could be over and might signal brighter times ahead for the country's grocers. However, if we see it the other direction, I would be very surprised if we saw continued deflation. That might mean a rough few months ahead for this country's grocers. Now, keep in mind, a lot of analysts and economists project that food inflation will hit towards the end of 2017 or the beginning of 2018, where Kroger and other grocers might begin to see higher top-line revenue and just perhaps greater margins. That'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. Check us out on Twitter, at Retail Podcast. Have an idea for a story or an interview? Send us an email, retailpodcast@gmail.com. And don't forget to subscribe to us on YouTube, where we'll be putting up weekly quick scans of the early week's retail news to kind of tide you over in between podcasts. For Leighton, I'm Trent. So long until next week.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.